From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Today, I submitted my resignation as Deputy Chief of Staff and Senior Advisor, effective the end of the month.
Karl Rove is stepping down. The move comes while he's at the center of several congressional investigations. Today, we'll speak with Texas journalist James Moore, author of Bush's Brain and The Architect. Then, as two journalists are assassinated in Somalia, we'll look at war crimes there and a new Human Rights Watch report on abuses in Mogadishu by U.S.-backed Ethiopian soldiers, the transitional Somali government, and insurgents. Then, in Utah, still no sign of the trapped miners.
I'm very disappointed to be telling you on the eighth day that we have not found six alive miners.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate Judiciary Committee has vowed to continue its investigation into Karl Rove even after he resigns as President Bush's top advisor at the end of August. Rove has refused to comply with a Judiciary Committee subpoena to testify about his role in the politicization of the Justice Department and the firing of nine U.S. attorneys. Senator Patrick Leahy said, quote, Mr. Rove's apparent attempts to manipulate elections and push out prosecutors citing bogus claims of voter fraud shows corruption of federal law enforcement for partisan political purposes. Congressmember John Conyers said the House Judiciary Committee would also continue to investigate Rove. Hours after Rove's resignation was reported in the Wall Street Journal, President Bush thanked Rove for his service.
Karl Rove is moving on down the road. I've been talking to Karl for a while about his desire to spend more time with Darby and Andrew. This is a family that's made enormous sacrifices, not only for our beloved state of Texas, but for a country we both love.
Karl Rove then praised President Bush.
I've seen a man of far-sighted courage put America on a war footing and protect us against a brutal enemy in a dangerous conflict that will shape this new century. I've seen a leader respond to an economy weakened by recession, corporate scandal, and terrorist attacks by taking decisive action to strengthen the economy and create jobs. I've seen a reformer who challenged his administration, the Congress, and the country to make bold changes to important institutions in great need of repair.
The Comptroller General of the U.S. government is warning there are striking similarities between the current situation in the United States and the end of the Roman Empire. In a new report, David Walker said the U.S. is now facing many of the same factors that brought down Rome, including, quote, declining moral values and political civility at home, an overconfident and overextended military in foreign lands, and fiscal irresponsibility by the central government. Walker predicted the U.S. is on a path toward an explosion of debt, as Comptroller General Walker is in charge of the nonpartisan Government Accountability Office, often described as the investigative arm of Congress. The Los Angeles Times is reporting the Justice Department is putting the final touches on regulations that would allow Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez to grant states the power to fast-track the execution of death row prisoners. Under the rules, Gonzalez could allow prosecutors to shorten the time prisoners have to appeal convictions to federal courts. Advocates for death row prisoners and some legal experts say the rules could increase the chances of the state executing innocent people. Catherine Case of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers said, quote, this is the Bush administration throwing down the gauntlet and saying we are going to speed up executions. The Bush administration has designated the Lebanese group Fatah al-Islam as terrorist organization. For the past 12 weeks, the militant group has been engaged in a bloody fight with the Lebanese military at a Palestinian refugee camp. At least 278 people have died and 40,000 Palestinian refugees have been displaced. Prior to the outbreak and fighting, investigative reporter Seymour Hersh reported the U.S. and Saudi governments have been covertly backing militant Sunni groups like Fatah al-Islam as part of an overarching foreign policy against Iran and growing Shiite influence in the Middle East. In media news, a federal judge has ordered five reporters to testify about their sources in the deadly anthrax mailings case after 9/11. The order comes as part of a lawsuit filed by former Army scientist Stephen Hatfield. He contends the unnamed sources at the Justice Department and FBI leaked information in an attempt to tie him to the anthrax attacks. The reporters who've been ordered to testify are Michael Isikoff and Daniel Kleigman of Newsweek, Alan Lengel of The Washington Post, Tony Losi, formerly of USA Today, and James Stewart, formerly of CBS News. Hundreds of environmental activists have begun setting up camp outside Heathrow Airport in Britain to expose the link between aviation and global warming. Protesters are expected to take part in the Camp for Climate Action for the next 7 days.
Well, it's the fastest growing source of greenhouse gases, and the British government is intending to expand 21 different airports around the country. Now, if they do that, that's the equivalent to building a new Heathrow every 5 years. And basically, in a time of climate crisis, that's absolute madness. If they do that, the emissions that they'll create from building those airports and expanding those airports is equivalent to our whole quota of what we're supposed to be emitting by 2050. So we use up all of our quota just on aviation before we switch on a single light or before we heat a single room.
A day of action at Heathrow is planned for Sunday. The Guardian newspaper reports armed police plan to use anti-terrorism laws to deal with the climate change protesters. The law gives police powers to stop and search people and vehicles for anything that could be used in connection with terrorism, search people even if they do not have evidence to suspect them, hold people for up to a month without charge, and search homes. Meanwhile, here in this country, five activists have been arrested in Asheville, North Carolina, during a direct action targeting Bank of America. The protests came at the end of the Southeast Convergence for Climate Action. The activists urged Bank of America to stop investing in coal companies. In recent years, Bank of America facilitated hundreds of millions of dollars in loans to companies like Massey Energy and Arch Coal that are involved in mountaintop removal coal mining. In Rhode Island, a 22-year-old woman has been hospitalized after police in Providence broke up a protest organized by the Industrial Workers of the World. Photographs show the woman, Alexandra Svoboda, was tackled by police. According to the Providence Journal, she's had one surgery to repair the damaged knee and may face another. The protest took place outside a Chinese restaurant named Jackie's Galaxy. The IWW targeted the restaurant for its alleged ties to the New York distributor Dragonland Trading. Members of the IWW accused Dragonland of forcing its staff to work up to 110 hours per week without basic labor rights. The State Department is coming under criticism this week for refusing to allow a prominent South African social scientist to enter the country. Adam Habib was scheduled to speak at the annual meeting of the American Sociological Association in New York, but the government has refused to give him a visa. Habib is executive director of the South Africa-based Human Science Research Council's Program on Democracy and Governance. He's also a Muslim of Indian descent who's been a vocal critic of the war in Iraq. Last October, Habib was detained when he arrived at a New York airport for a series of academic meetings here in the United States. His visa was revoked without explanation, and he was put on a flight back to South Africa. A drive-by shooting targeted Pacifica radio station KPFT in Houston early Monday morning. A bullet blasted through a plexiglass window in the station's studio. At the time of the shooting, Mary Thomas was hosting a Zydeco music program. The bullet came within 18 inches of her head. No one was injured in the shooting. Station manager Dwayne Bradley said the shooting might have been political. Bradley said, quote, "It's highly likely that at some point someone may have heard something that offended them and they decided to do something about it." KPFT has been the target of attacks before. Shortly after the Houston station went on the air in 1970, the Ku Klux Klan blew up the station's transmitter with dynamite, and then they did it again. And the civil rights pioneer Irene Morgan Kirkcaldy has died at the age of 90. More than a decade before Rosa Parks made headlines around the world, Irene Morgan challenged the nation's Jim Crow laws by refusing to give up her seat on a Greyhound bus to a white couple. Her rebellion led to her arrest. Her case eventually went to the U.S. Supreme Court. 2 years later, in the case Morgan v. Virginia, the court sided with her and declared interstate bus segregation unconstitutional. Her case inspired the first formal freedom ride. In 1947, an interracial group led by civil rights leader Bayard Rustin traveled by bus and train from Washington, D.C. to Louisville, Kentucky, to challenge southern states to implement the Supreme Court's decision in the case. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Calvin Singh here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Amidst continuing violence in Somalia, the international advocacy group Human Rights Watch is accusing the U.S.-backed Ethiopian government, the transitional Somali government it brought to power, as well as insurgent groups, of committing war crimes in the capital of Mogadishu. The report was released Monday, just as the U.N. Security Council began deliberations over sending a peacekeeping force to Somalia. It documents the indiscriminate bombing, shooting, and summary executions that took place at the height of the violence and caused hundreds of deaths and over 400,000 people to be displaced. The armed conflict in Somalia has escalated since the Ethiopian government and U.S. forces ousted the Union of Islamic Courts last December and helped install the Somali transitional federal government in January. Insurgent groups began attacking Ethiopian troops and the transitional government. Ethiopian forces responded with two major bombing raids in March and April of this year. The Human Rights Watch estimates could have killed up to 1,300 civilians. The space for dissent and independent voices has been severely curtailed in this period. On Saturday, two prominent radio journalists were assassinated in Mogadishu, hours apart. They were leading figures at the independent broadcaster Horn Afrique that has been critical of both the Islamists and the pro-U.S. interim government. In April of this year, Horn Afrique's studios were destroyed by shelling from Ethiopian forces. Following the assassinations, this is what Somali journalist Yasmin Mayal had to say.
From today, I am afraid to go to work as a journalist. And I can see now the target is local journalists being threatened and killed.
Steve Crawshaw is the UN Advocacy Director at Human Rights Watch. Saeed Samattar is a professor of history at Rutgers University who specializes in Somalia. They join me now in the Firehouse studio here in New York. Welcome you both to Democracy Now! This is a major report Human Rights Watch has just put out. Can you describe your findings?
It is, as you say, an important report, not least because so little really detailed information has been coming out of Somalia, partly because it is so dangerous. You described some of it in your introduction, but we have seen crimes committed by all sides, by the rebels, by the transitional government, and by the Ethiopian forces there. And this is not just something which might have happened by mistake, if you like. This is deliberate targeting civilians, the shelling of civilian areas, knowing that civilians are there, block by block, the attack on a hospital, again, deliberate targeting of a hospital and then trashing of that hospital afterwards, summary executions of civilians. This is something where civilian life has simply been absolutely treated as trash, to be frank. And I think the rest of the world needs finally to focus in the ways it's been very reluctant to until now.
Can you explain who the forces are? What is the government doing there and who installed it?
We've got the transitional government that was already there, the Ethiopian forces, which went in last year and which were against the Islamic group that was there. And you have so the rebels, which from the U.S. government, or let alone the Ethiopian government formulation, would be seen as the dangerous Islamic rebels, which they are confronting. The trouble is that what's happened with the crimes committed by the Ethiopian forces is really making even more unstable a situation which was already unstable enough. We have a reconciliation conference that has been going on, so there is some kind of political movement, theoretically. But the trouble is, when you have these kind of crimes against civilians on this kind of scale, and a great reluctance by the UN Security Council and the rest of the world to really focus on how many of those crimes are going on. People say, well, let's look at the political process. It's very difficult to look at a political process when you're not even bothering to protect the civilians.
Saeed Samattar, explain the political situation right now and how the government came into being in Somalia.
Well, the political situation really is not limited, it's not confined to Somalia. It's a regional issue. As you know, Ethiopia has helped the transitional government to come to power in the last days of December 2006. And, of course, the Eritreans are fishing in the troubled waters of Somalia. So you have got two proxy wars being waged, one on behalf of the United States government, and that's Ethiopia, and you have got Eritrean involvement in Somalia. And so this is a no-win situation. I'm afraid that unless we find a genuine political settlement, you're going to have more and more bloodshed.
The level of abuse right now, what you call war crimes, Steve Crenshaw,
Is very, very high. And I think that it is really, in a sense, even higher because there is a sense there that they're not going to be punished for it. There needs to be that sense there is not an impunity. If you are targeting, I say, for example, in the center of Mogadishu, block by block, they would reset the coordinates in order to attack block by block, knowing that so many civilians were there. And when civilians were trying to flee, they were even killed as they tried to flee. And I think that that is something which we're really... It's frankly as bad as it can get. And I think that it is extraordinary that there's been such what seems almost like a determination to not look at what is happening there. It is very bad in that situation.
What is Human Rights Watch recommending?
Above all, we are looking for whatever force is in there. We have the African peacekeeping force at the moment, and there's now the discussions yesterday and continuing this week about the possibility of a UN force going into Somalia. There has to be a strong civilian protection mandate. Again and again, we see the problem of a force going in, but it's not actually tasked to be able robustly to protect civilians. And that's what you need. It is the bottom line. It's sometimes seen as, oh, the soft thing we'll deal that with once the politics are over. But this is... It makes no sense. If you don't address the civilian protection, that is not going to move you forward at all. You need, on a whole range of issues, I think the UN High Commissioner on Human Rights, her office, could play a stronger role. But the bottom line throughout this is civilian protection and understanding that crimes are crimes. We see at the moment, I think it's quite eloquent in its way, that the Ethiopian government has reacted calling all of this fabrications. I think that they would be better advised to look at the crimes that are being committed, and that other governments should understand that these are not fabrications. Of course they're not.
How does the violence compare now to last year before the U.S.-backed Ethiopian invasion?
It was an extremely unstable situation before in Mogadishu and Somalia, and Mogadishu in particular, but Somalia in general. Of course, there has been violence throughout. I think that what one needs to focus on here is we have a powerful government. This is not just anarchy. The Ethiopian forces who are there and are committing these crimes, they blanket, if you like, in the sense that, well, this is anarchy and we have to kind of get the anarchy back under control. This is not getting anarchy back under control. On the contrary, if you kill civilians in this kind of way, knowingly killing civilians and deliberately killing civilians, or alternatively using weapons, which clearly where the it will be disproportionately civilians who will die, that's not helping to bring anarchy under control.
Mahad Ahmed Elmi was one of the two Horn of Freak journalists killed this weekend. Elmi was the director of Capital Voice Radio, a private station owned by Horn of Freak Media, and also worked as a freelance reporter for McClatchy newspapers. He was shot four times in the head on his way to work on Saturday morning. We're joined now on the phone from Nairobi by Shashank Bangali, the Nairobi bureau chief for McClatchy newspapers. He worked with Mahad Ahmed Elmi. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy. How are you?
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about your last conversation with Elmi?
Yes, I spoke to Mahad on Friday afternoon, the day before he was killed. He was going to spend the weekend compiling some reports for us at McClatchy newspapers about the progress of the reconciliation conference that's been going on in Mogadishu over the past month. Mahad was talking to me about how the conference had achieved very little, and there was growing fears among people in Mogadishu that the whole long-awaited conference that had been put off for months and months because of fears of violence that everyone had sort of put their hopes into, that it could help achieve political reconciliation, that conference wasn't really going anywhere. So we were going to try to put together a story for this week that looked at that.
Was he afraid?
You know, Mahad was never the type of person to say he was afraid or not. Over the last several months that we worked together, since about November of last year, we worked very closely, spoke to him about once a week at least in that time. And he never, you know, I always asked him, you know, how are you getting around? How safe are you there? And there was a couple times when I know he was definitely a little more apprehensive, especially in March and April when violence was really getting out of hand. But he didn't say anything to me on Friday. He was, in fact, planning to be married to his fiancée on August the 20th, and he was talking about that. And I asked him whether he was still planning on going ahead with the ceremony, and he said, yes, you know, why not? We can't wait for the violence to stop. So he was really more focusing on that than anything else.
Now, he was killed soon after. Had he spoken at the funeral of his colleague?
I believe so. I spoke to Ali Imam Shamarke, the other man who was killed, one of the co-owners of Horn of Freak, just after Mahad died. I spoke to him about 9 or 10 a.m. on Saturday morning, and he told me that he was waiting at Horn of Freak, waiting to receive Mahad's family, who was coming to the station, and they were all going to go to the funeral of Mahad together. I assume that Ali said something. I don't actually know what happened, because a few hours later when I tried to reach Ali on the phone, of course, he had already been killed. And that was the last I heard from Ali, was that he was planning on going to the funeral. And then, of course, that was the last we heard from him.
Shashank Bangali, who do you believe is responsible?
It's very hard to say, Amy. What Ali told me in the hours after Mahad said was death was that Horn of Freak had lately been angering both sides of the conflict, pro-government groups and pro-Islamist insurgent groups, because they had been doing quite a bit of reporting on the civilians who'd been caught up in the recent fighting. Mahad had done quite a few interviews in hospitals with people who had been victims of crossfire, people who had lost family members in some of what he was calling the indiscriminate attacks by both sides in crowded parts of the city. So both groups had, according to Ali, both groups had reason to be angry at Horn Afrik. The thing that is a little more concerning is what, of course, happened to Ali. The way he was killed was a remote-controlled roadside bomb, and that's not a tactic that's really used by anyone except for what we broadly call the insurgent groups. Now, these are it's really hard to generalize, but that's a tactic that they've been using more and more, is the anti-government forces. So that tactic certainly would lead you to believe that it would be insurgents, but the way Mahad was killed and the reasons why he was killed, you can't really imagine why anyone would want to silence a journalist who's doing his job unless they have something to hide.
And what are you doing now about coverage of Somalia? How is McClatchy Newspapers dealing with this?
Well, it's certainly going to be much more difficult for us. I mean, beyond losing a friend in Mahad and a wonderful guy, we've also lost a very talented and brave journalist, someone who was providing us with reports constantly a few times a week, which is sort of updates on what was happening. And I'm afraid that because of the brutal way in which the media has been cracked down upon now since this weekend, a lot of journalists are going to go underground and be more fearful about reporting things honestly. And I feel like people who are also contributing to foreign media, such as ourselves, are going to feel like they are going to be watched more closely by whoever was behind these terrible attacks over the weekend. So we are going to have to I think we're going to take a wait-and-see approach for the moment and see if we can't find someone just as brave as Mahad who's willing to help us out. I can say that I've already received several emails from journalists in Mogadishu who have volunteered their services. So certainly it won't be it's not like there aren't any more people left in Somalia who want to get word out about what's happening in their country. But finding someone of Mahad's caliber is certainly going to be a challenge.
Shashank Bangali, thanks so much for joining us. Nairobi Bureau Chief from McClatchy Newspapers. As we wrap up, Saeed Sheikh Samatar, what do you think people need to understand about the situation right now in Somalia?
Well, first, if I may, on the question of who did this assassination to the journals, a rumor circulating among Somalis has it that a week prior to the act of assassination, this gentleman, or at least one of them, received a letter threatening assassination if he didn't lay off. I don't know what they were asking him to lay off from. And that rumor points to the Islamists. As far as
those in power now,
those who have been thrown out of power. As far as any kind of hope for Somalia, you have got to have a political settlement. The Ethiopians, I never thought that they would come when I would be defending the Ethiopian presence in Somalia because I do not like their being there. But you have got a tit-for-tat situation wherein these insurgents go to heavily populated civilian areas, hide, shell the Ethiopians, and Ethiopians respond with indiscriminate shelling. They realize that no army, however powerful, however its firepower, has ever defeated an insurgency short of genocide. And I'm afraid until a political settlement is found, you will have, this would be like a Sunday out, and you would have much more worse situation of civilian deaths.
I want to thank you both for joining us, Steve Crawshaw, UN Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch, and Saeed Samatar, Professor of African History at Rutgers University. His specialty is Somalia. Thank you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Utah, rescuers are still trying to reach six coal miners who've been trapped more than 1,800 feet underground for the past 8 days. There's been no sign of the six men since the Crandall Canyon mine in central Utah caved in last week. Bob Murray, head of Murray Energy Corporation and co-owner of the mine, spoke at a news conference yesterday in the nearby town of Huntington.
I'm very disappointed to be telling you on the eighth day that we have not found six alive miners. It has been the hope and prayer of all of us. As I have said before, the initial concussion of the seismic activity could have killed these miners outright, and they would not have suffered. However, I want to emphasize that there are many, many reasons to have hope still. There are many reasons why one would believe that they still may be alive.
Images from a video camera lowered into the collapsed mine revealed equipment, but no sign of the miners. Officials said they were preparing to drill a third hole deep into the earth in the hopes of finding them. It's still unclear what caused the mine to collapse. Bob Murray has insisted it was caused by an earthquake, but seismologists say there was no earthquake and that readings on seismometers actually came from the collapse. One of the four miners who escaped alive said Sunday he didn't feel or hear a thing as the mountain shook and caved in. All six trap miners have been identified by their families. Three of them are Mexican citizens. Ellen Smith is the owner and managing editor of Mine Safety and Health News. She's been covering mining-related issues since 1987 and has won numerous journalism awards for her reporting. She joins me now from Rochester, New York. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Can you lay out at this point what you understand has taken place, starting from what the men were doing in the mine when the collapse, when the accident occurred?
Right. The men were doing something called retreat mining, and it's, of course, something that Mr. Murray has denied. But they weren't retreat mining in the sense of cutting away the pillars completely. It's what we call splitting the pillars, which is taking coal from the remaining pillars. And what two experts believe right now, and that would be Bob Ferreter and Larry Grayson, who are very highly esteemed mining engineers in this industry, they believe that because you had two mined out sections on either side of where they were cutting their pillars, it was too much stress on the remaining pillars, and so therefore you had the huge bounce or the pillars and ribs gave out.
What do you mean, Ellen, that this was denied, this kind of mining?
Mr. Murray has said we were not retreat mining, and but then again, Mr. Murray has also said this was an earthquake, and the U.S. Geological Survey said that they're 99% sure that the seismic readings were from, in fact, the mine caving in and not an earthquake-related seismic event.
What is Bob Murray's history? Explain exactly who he is, what he owns.
You know, Mr. Murray has a fairly checkered history. He's got 27 mines right now that are working or temporarily idled for one reason or another. We've written about him. He first came to my attention in 1993, and it's because it was a fairly sad case where a mine foreman lost his arm in one of Mr. Murray's underground coal mines, and he bled to death before they could get him to the surface. Now, according to a witness, about a week before this accident occurred, Mr. Murray had said to 40 miners that under no circumstances were they to turn off the belt line, because if you can't move coal out of the mine, you're not making money. And he said, I don't want that belt turned off unless there's a man in it. A week later, there's a problem on the belt line. A foreman goes to see what's wrong. He didn't turn the belt off, and his arm got caught in the conveyor belt and ripped off. I mean, it was a very, very sad case. Now, they weren't arguing the point of law of what Mr. Murray said, but the point of law was whether or not this foreman was doing repair and maintenance to the belt where it should have been turned off. And that was really unclear in the case. But what wasn't disputed was what Mr. Murray said in front of these miners. He had another mine called Ken American Resources, where the supervisors were found guilty of felony Mine Act violations for trying to cover up an accident, lying to investigators, giving advanced warning to the miners underground that mine inspectors were coming in. They would say, company's coming. And so that way, the miners could try to get some of the safety features in place, like the ventilation curtains up. Putting up ventilation curtains, of course, takes more time when you're mining. And those, they were found guilty. Now, Mr. Murray, you have to understand, has never been found guilty himself. It's been supervisors, foremen. But we always say in this industry that safety starts from the top down. At his Powhatan No. 6 mine, he was in big arguments with the Mine Safety and Health Administration officials over problems they had there, over citations he got, over the fact that they wanted to close down a longwall section to make the mine safer. And we have meeting notes where he was screaming, you're costing me $15,000 an hour. I'm losing tens of millions of dollars. So, you know, he really does have a checkered past. Now, we have to temper this whole accident scene right now at Crandall by saying that it appears that they were following the mining plan, and that mine plan was approved by the government, by the Mine Safety and Health Administration, and a very well-known engineering company was the one that designed that plan.
What about the families, the miners themselves, their families? How long have they been mining here? And also on the issue of not turning off the conveyor belt, why would Bob Murray not want it turned off? What does it do?
Well, I mean, if you don't have the belt running, you can't get coal out of the mine. And that's the bottom line. If you're running the belt, you move the coal out. Without the conveyor belt, you can't move the coal out. In terms of how long they've been mining in this mine, I was briefly looking at the mine map yesterday, and they were mining panels 11 years ago. So this mine has been active for quite some time now. I'm sure it goes back farther than 11 years. It might go back to the late 80s.
We're talking to Ellen Smith, who is the owner and managing editor of Mine Safety and Health News. Ellen, can you talk about MSHA? Explain what it is and how effective is it?
MSHA is the Mine Safety and Health Administration. It's the federal OSHA that covers mining exclusively. It's in every state. They cover coal mines, sand and gravel pits, quarries, gold mines, silver mines, any form of mining MSHA is going to cover. Now, if you're an underground mine operator, you can expect to see an MSHA inspector no less than four times a year. Those are for regular inspections. If you're a surface operator, you will get at least two inspections a year. Now, these are general inspections, and they don't include the specialized inspections. What we saw at Mr. Murray's mine is that beginning on May 25th, they had special roof control inspectors in that mine at Crandall to see what was going on. You'll have ventilation specialists come in. You'll have electrical specialists come in. So in addition to your four underground mine inspections, which are mandated under the 1977 Mine Act, you can also expect to see these specialists in the mine to pinpoint where there may be problems. And that's the thing about Mr. Murray's mine. They had an ongoing roof control specialist there from the government starting on May 25th. As well, They had inspectors there as late as July, I believe, 17th is what we saw. So MSHA had a presence at this mine.
We're talking to Ellen Smith about the mine disaster. Do you expect to find these men alive, that they will be found alive?
You know, every passing day, it's really a difficult situation. In the beginning, I kept reminding people that miners have survived circumstances in which we thought no one could live. In 1995, we saw a huge mine collapse in Wyoming. It measured 3,000 by 7,000 feet, and two miners initially survived. Unfortunately, one died as he was being rescued, and it was 40 hours later. We're past the 40-hour mark. I mean, these guys could have been injured. We just don't know, but it's not looking good. And now, as we all know this morning, or as of yesterday, 12 of the mine rescue team members asked to be removed from working at the advancing area where they were working trying to get in the mine because they are worried for their own safety. This is something I've brought up from the beginning. This is an extremely dangerous, dangerous rescue. These men are being placed in a precarious situation. They're all volunteering for it, but it's very dangerous for the rescuers. And it really doesn't look good for those miners that are trapped.
What is MSHA's record, the government's record, on mine safety and health during the Bush administration?
Well, unfortunately, in the early years, and this actually started under Clinton, where they did not replace retiring MSHA employees. It was a way to kind of softly handle the budget cuts of the agency. That continued through the Bush administration, and then we ran into a problem in the early years of the administration where the MSHA inspectors were not able to inspect all the mines. I had metal and non-metal mines out west tell me at one point they had not seen a mine inspector in 2 years when they should be seeing a mine inspector twice a year. So, obviously, the mine inspections weren't being met. Now, Sago last year and Darby and the Aracoma mine fire were amazing wake-up calls for this industry. On the part of industry, the part of the public, and the part of the Mine Safety and Health Administration. At that point, they started trying to hire more inspectors, but I have to say it takes 2 years to fully train a mine inspector. So we can expect to see that for 2 years, you know, they're going to be working out these issues with meeting inspections, training new inspectors. They have a shortage of qualified people that can look at these engineering plans. I mean, employees tell me that they are overworked and doing the best that they can do under the situation. The MSHA employees are incredibly dedicated to mine safety, but, you know, there's only so much that one person can do in a work week, and they need more employees. They have the money for new employees. It's trying to find the people with the experience that can do the work. And the bottom line is, you make more money when you work for a private mining company than you make working for the government. And maybe that's something that they need to look at is, you know, making up those salaries so we can get the qualified people working for this agency.
Final question about this second accident within this last week, this one in Indiana, of three construction workers falling to their death, Ellen Smith.
Right. Yeah, it's, you know, we're just learning the details right now. They were building a ventilation shaft. We've had these accidents before. We've had...
This in Indiana?
Yes. And we've had, in fact, bucket accidents at least twice this year where people have gotten hurt. They've fallen out. They weren't wearing their safety belts that they were supposed to be wearing. Now, we don't have all the details on this accident. Things are sketchy. Again, the Mine Safety and Health Administration press officer is overwhelmed right now with Crandall, and she does not have a lot of time to answer all these questions, unfortunately, that we have about this other accident. The mine where it happened has a fairly good safety record. Of course, we've said that about Crandall as well, you know, which brings up another point. And that is, when have we in the mining industry, and I put myself in this position, when have we said that a few accidents are okay, that a few citations are okay, that it has a fairly good history compared to other mines? And, you know, this is something I'm kind of questioning in myself these last couple days, that when is it okay to say that 300 or 200 violations a year are okay?
Well, Ellen Smith, we will leave it there, but of course, continue to follow the story. Ellen Smith, owner and managing editor of Mine Safety and Health News, has been covering mining-related issues for decades. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, Karl Rove is stepping down. We'll talk about it. Stay with us.
Cover it up these days, and there's no one to claim it or care if he's gone away, for he was only a miner, and it's only
Hazel Dickens, Coal Miner's Grave, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting over 500 stations around the country on Pacific and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations on public access TV and PBS TV stations and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman, as we turn now to President Bush's top advisor, Karl Rove, the man nicknamed Bush's brain and the architect, who announced on Monday he'll step down as White House Deputy Chief of Staff at the end of the month. Bush and Rove have known each other for over three decades. Rove helped guide Bush to the Texas governorship and later to two terms in the White House. They appeared together yesterday on the South Lawn to address reporters. Bush began by thanking his longtime advisor.
We've been friends for a long time. And we're still going to be friends. I would call Karl Rove a dear friend. We've known each other as youngsters interested in serving our state. And we worked together so we could be in a position to serve this country. And so I thank my friend. I'll be on the road behind you here in a little bit. I thank Darby and I thank Karl for making a tremendous sacrifice. And wish you all the very best.
Today, I submitted my resignation as Deputy Chief of Staff and Senior Advisor effective the end of the month. Mr. President, I'm grateful for the opportunity you gave me to serve our nation and you. I'm grateful for being able to work with the extraordinary men and women that you've drawn into this administration. And I'm grateful to have been a witness to history. It has been the joy and the honor of a lifetime. I've seen a man of far-sighted courage put America on a war footing and protect us against a brutal enemy in a dangerous conflict that will shape this new century. I've seen a leader respond to an economy weakened by recession, corporate scandal, and terrorist attacks by taking decisive action to strengthen the economy and create jobs. I've seen a reformer who challenged his administration, the Congress, and the country to make bold changes to important institutions in great need of repair. Mr. President, the world's turned many times since our journey began. We've been at this a long time. It was over 14 years ago that you began your run for governor, and over 10 years ago that we started thinking and planning about a possible run for the presidency. And it's been an exhilarating and eventful time. Through it all, you've remained the same man. Your integrity, character, and decency have remained unchanged and inspiring. Through all those years, I've asked a lot of my family, and they've given all I've asked and more. And now it seems the right time to start thinking about the next chapter in our family's life.
While Karl Rove says he's resigning in order to spend more time with his family, the move comes while he's at the center of several congressional investigations. Last month, Senate Judiciary Chair Patrick Leahy subpoenaed Rove to testify about his role in the politicization of the Justice Department and the firing of 9 U.S. attorneys. So far, Rove has ignored the subpoenas, refused to testify, citing executive privilege. In addition, 2 weeks ago, Rove skipped a congressional hearing on the allegedly improper use by White House aides of Republican National Committee email accounts. Leahy has vowed to continue the investigation. Speaking to reporters aboard Air Force One, Rove said, quote, "I'm Moby Dick and they're after me." Rove previously escaped indictment in the CIA leak case, while then White House spokesman Scott McClellan initially publicly denied Rove had anything to do with the leak. The special prosecutor's investigation later determined he had, in fact, divulged or confirmed undercover CIA operative Valerie Plame's identity to columnist Robert Novak and Time magazine reporter Matthew Cooper. Wayne Slater is the senior political reporter for the Dallas Morning News and co-author of 2 books about Rove: Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential, and most recently, The Architect, Karl Rove and the Master Plan for Absolute Power. Wayne Slater joins me now on the phone from Texas. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Great to be with you, Amy.
Your response to this news?
Well, the first thing, of course, that comes to mind is when anybody in Washington says they're resigning to spend more time with their family, the thing you know for sure is they're not resigning to spend more time with their family. But, you know, it was the time to go. The truth is this administration is over. There will be no more big initiatives. There are no more reelection races. And with respect to the campaigns ahead, the Republican candidates for president are trying to distance themselves from George Bush, not associate themselves. It was time for Rove to go.
What do you think of the way in which he made the announcement, the Wall Street Journal, no, not the news pages, to Paul Jugot, the editorial page editor?
But of course, I mean, you know, that's not unusual. That's who he was talking to. It's a friendly newspaper, by and large, certainly the business-minded newspaper. I mean, what Karl has done is prepared the way for the next step. And on the positive side, from Karl's point of view, what he intends to do, and he really indicated that. If you listen to, you know, the statement that you just played, the remarks he made yesterday on the South Lawn, he will become the fiercest advocate for George Bush and the Bush years, the Bush legacy, and by extension, the Rove legacy, by writing books and by speaking for the next few years. He's an historian. He sees himself as an amateur historian, and he knows that this is a disaster of a presidency. This is absolutely a debacle. And he knows that in order to either explain or, as others would say, redefine and resurrect this disaster of a presidency, he's got to get in there and be part of the early historical record. That's his hope. It's a long, long shot.
What does this mean for George Bush? You have written in the Dallas Morning News just today, the resignation of Rove means the last and most important member of George W. Bush's Texas inner circle is gone.
You know, the thing about George Bush is, one of the things Karl said yesterday, I've seen a man who hasn't changed. That's true. George Bush is very much the same person I remember talking to in the early 1980s here in Texas, with the strengths that he has and all the flaws that he has. And one of the flaws is that he surrounded himself then, and more dangerously in the White House, with a few people, a few loyalists. Among the early group of loyalists were these Texans who were super loyal to Bush and whose advice and counsel he trusted. But one by one, they've all left. Karen Hughes has left, Jill Alba has left, and on down the line. Carl was the most important and the closest advisor to the president. He wasn't just a political consultant. He's the guy who basically put together, in an effective way, the politics of division and raised the politics of division, of exploiting polarization, exploiting the wedge issues of gay marriage, of fear of terrorism, in a politically efficient way in order to win 2002, 2004. But those principles, that approach, came back to haunt him and sent the House of Cards, really contributed to the House of Cards falling down in 2006.
Wayne Slater, what does this mean for the congressional investigations in which he's invoked executive privilege? He didn't show up at one. Does he still remain at the center of them? Is he less protected stepping out?
Right. There are two things here, Amy. One is that he still very much is the focus of an investigation in Washington on this matter, not simply by members of Congress, but more importantly to him, the Justice Department. And so he remains there. But all the associations that he has with the president, the effort and the claim of executive privilege, stays, even if he leaves for private life. So he will try to do, and Bush will try to do, what they've done in the past, and that is to try to wait this thing out. The only question is now whether an indictment or other charges could come in the future or the near future. Frankly, my experience with Carl is that he always escapes. And so looking at the history of the guy from the late 1980s through the current situation tells me he most likely will escape this latest round of both political inquiry and federal investigation. I could be wrong. Only time will tell.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Wayne Slater, for joining us. Wayne Slater is with the Dallas Morning News, senior political reporter and author of two books, co-author with James Moore, Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential, and The Architect, Karl Rove and the Master Plan for Absolute Power. Thanks for joining us. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Maté, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman. Also, special thanks to Kieran Krug-Meadows and John Randolph and Becca Staley, Laura as well, Chipley, and special thanks to Sharif Abdelkaddous. DemocracyNow.org is our website. There you can sign up for our headlines as well as get our media alerts and get the transcripts of the broadcast. Also, thanks to Elizabeth Press. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.